You're listening to the Co-Main Event Podcast. And now your hosts, Ben Folks and Chad Dundas.
That's right. You're listening to another episode of the Co-Main Event Mixed Martial Arts Podcast. I'm Chad Dundas. That's Ben Folks. We're both senior writers in MMA for The Athletic, and we meet here every single week to chop up all the prominent, newsworthy, and hilarious happenings in the world of mixed martial arts. So, Ben, here's where we are this week. UFC 249 officially canceled, as we said during Friday's Power Hour over on our Patreon page. We somewhat hoped that that would be the final word, that we would be able to stop talking about UFC 249 until it becomes a reality once again, once the UFC and other mainstream sports resume their regularly scheduled seasons and slates of live events. But we're going to circle back here on this episode of the podcast to address UFC 249 one final time, fill in some of the details there regarding the cancellation. And we also got a lot of listener mail here about topics unrelated to UFC 249. So we think this week, as we continue to respond to a fluid and changing, sometimes depressing situation here, we'll spend the first half of the show doing listener mail. And the second half, we'll get into these regularly scheduled three rounds about UFC 249. How are you today?
I'm doing all right. I'm settling into our new normal.
Good. That's good to hear. That's good to hear. Any updates there from up on the hill, Castle Folks?
Well, I'll tell you what. It was Easter yesterday, as you well know, which meant I got to play the same game of rehide and refine the Easter eggs with my children about a half dozen times. I feel like one good thing about being in quarantine, stuck in this house for a few weeks leading up to Easter, is that I know the nook and crannies pretty well at this point, man. You're not really going to hide an egg anywhere that I haven't really thought about already, because I've just been sitting around here staring at the same four walls over and over again. Feel like it really, without me realizing it, it brought my Easter egg finding game to a whole new level.
So the Easter Bunny not able to put one over on Ben Folks this year.
Not this year. Better luck next year.
That's a positive.
Yeah.
You know what I like about this? You're focusing on the positives. Your Easter egg finding game only been improved by this quarantine.
Don't worry, I'll bring it back with some negatives later on.
All right, well, we got music again this week from Stockholm-based producer Cimeo, a.k.a. Co-Main Event podcast listener Alfred Larson. If you like what you hear from him on the show, you can check out more over at soundcloud.com/Cimeo. That's S-E-E-M-I-O, Cimeo. We got three rounds, as usual, this week in the Co-Main Event podcast. In round number one, everybody showed their ass around UFC 249's cancellation. What did we learn? And in round number two, what now will become of the interim lightweight championship? And in round number three, when fights do come back, what will this crazy sport even look like? All that plus, are you fucking kidding me and just saying stuff? Oh, I think we're going to do tips for the well-rounded fight fan this week, are we not, Ben?
Doesn't it seem like a week where we could all use some tips?
I think everyone needs all the tips that they can get. So we will be doing that. But like we always do about this time, let's get into this listener mail.
Listener mail.
First piece of listener mail this week comes to us from Nobby Buchholz.
Okay,
Nobby Buchholz, apparently he's experimenting with the spelling of his fake last name here, Ben. He's changing it up.
Or Nobby, somebody else.
Nobby Buchholz.
Is it a play off of Nobby Buchholz and Justin Buchholz?
I assume it is. I guess I don't know, and perhaps we will never know if it is in fact the original Nobby Buchholz or if it is some kind of imposter.
No way to know. It's best we assume that it's one of life's mysteries.
Maybe we'll be able to figure it out from the context of this email. He writes, I've been kicking this question around in my head for a while, so I figured I'd toss it your way and see what you think. Is Dundasso cheating? I asked this based on a question from a baseball podcast, Fangraphs Audio, in case any other baseball nerds are wondering, about the Houston Astros' banging scheme. The host and guest discussed several layers to what could be described as cheating. The first layer, does it work, is pretty obvious. That's the basis for the entire discipline. However, the second layer is more interesting to think about. If there are specific punishments built into the scoring system for fouls, or generally accepted, a la point deductions for repeated eye pokes slash groin strikes, loss of position for cage grabbing, etc., the offender has to calculate whether the point deduction is worth it. If you watch the ending of any basketball game, committing fouls is basically accepted and no one calls it cheating. Does that apply to Dundasso? I look forward to your interesting discourse, or as I like to call it, interdiscourse.
Nope. No, we're not going to do that. We're not going to start with this interdiscourse. This is interesting.
No, we're not.
This is an interesting kind of thought experiment, because we have also made this comparison to other sports in a different way, where we've said, hey, why is it that the referees so often content themselves with a verbal warning when they see someone breaking a known rule and doing so intentionally? Because if you're in a basketball game and you hack the guy on his forearm as he's going up for a jumper, the referee does not tell you, like, hey, don't do that again. We all know that's a foul. We go straight to the immediate punishment for the foul, and we don't really do that in MMA. So it is an interesting question, I guess, to ask yourself. Like, if you turn around the other way, if we know what the punishment is and we know that it's a foul and you're doing it, are fouls just kind of a part of the game? I mean, I would say the thing that makes it immediately and most obviously different here is that in MMA, the fouls could hurt people. And badly, and can really change the entire course of a fight. Whereas, you know, if you're hacking somebody in the last 2 minutes of a basketball game, I guess we feel like the action and the recourse are a little bit more honed in line with, like, with the sports general strategies, and to where, like, you're not going to end the game prematurely with 2 minutes left to go by committing a really effective foul. Whereas in MMA, you could commit an effective foul that really helps you end the fight right then and there, regardless of any punishments.
Yeah. I guess it's in some ways depends on what fouls you're talking about here. Like, you know, I could see resorting to a cage grab in, like, the last minute of a fight or something like that, if you wanted to prevent the takedown. If you felt like you were getting the better of the fight in the stand-up game, maybe something like that could be more or less analogous to, like, fouling down the stretch in basketball to try to keep the other team either from scoring or to prolong the game so you have a chance to come back, whatever it may be. But, like, I don't know that you could say the same thing about groin kicks, right?
Yeah.
You're not going to, like, you're not going to haul off and boot a guy in the pills in the last 2 minutes of a fight or whatever just so, like, you salt away the victory. I don't necessarily think that that's really all that comparable. On the other hand, though, like, I think it's interesting to think about the idea of employing these fouls judiciously if you feel like they give you a better chance to win the game or win the fight. Just because, you know, as the emailer notes here, that's a more accepted part of various sports. I think that there are a lot of sports where that's sort of accepted, but in mixed martial arts, we don't really think about it that way. And I think it does probably come down to the physical stakes. You know what I mean? Like, you're not really hurting a person in basketball if you foul them on purpose. You're not really in football, hopefully, hurting a person, like, if you hold them during a critical time in the game or something of that nature. Like in MMA, as you noted, many of the fouls are safety related there, but they're designed to, like, physically keep fighters from undergoing serious injury. So I don't necessarily know that we could extend the same charitable view to this sport that we do to others.
Right. Well, and, like, in the NBA, it is totally within your power to foul somebody in such a way as in order to hurt them. Like, that could be done. Like, you could really go after something. If you're like, hey, I'm going to take the foul on this one anyway, I might as well really hack them hard and really put them down and see if I can diminish what they're going to be capable of in the game going forward. And you've seen instances of that happening, and it is frowned upon in a very different way than just, like, hack a shack kind of strategies are. But there also, yeah. I mean, I think that there are kind of gray areas, like you say, with fighting. I was talking with my dad about this just the other day about how there are some fighters, and I think John Jones is a pretty good example, where you know he's going to go looking for some gray areas in the rules when you fight that guy. But also, some of it is like, there's some stuff that he does where you're like, that's not exactly cheating. A lot of people don't love it, like the straight on knee kicks or stuff like that, or just the way he uses his reach to kind of extend his hands and his fingers right in your eyes, just kind of daring you to lunge in there and poke yourself in the eye. But until he breaks the rules, and even if he does break the rules, it's up to the referee to decide how to punish him. But otherwise, it's up to you as his opponent to try to work around how to deal with that. Because, like, he, in a way, you'd be kind of crazy not to get away with all the space that there is between illegal and legal in a goddamn professional cage fight.
All right, here's what I'm going to do. In our first fight, I'm going to kick you in the nards as hard as I possibly can in the hopes that when the rematch rolls around, you're going to be suffering from low testosterone.
Okay. You're taking a long game kind of approach to this.
Yeah, very long. Very, very long game. Next question this week comes to us from Alex Dykeman. He writes, the John Jones arrest and subsequent plea seem to come and go pretty quickly. When the UFC is back to putting on events, do you think Jones will be subject to any disciplinary action? Ben, I was surprised about this, how quickly we got John Jones into court to enter a plea. I guess he pleaded guilty, correct, to some infraction, some kind of minor infraction after this traffic stop in Albuquerque where he'd been shooting his gun off and he was drunk and Wild Thing was calling him on the phone, something like that.
House arrest during the pandemic. How about that?
You could make the argument we were all already on house arrest.
Should have been all on a house arrest. I mean, if John Jones had been on house arrest for a lot of his career, he could have avoided a lot of these problems.
That's true. More to the point, when the UFC returns, I just don't see John Jones suffering any disciplinary action at all unless this particular arrest leads to some additional personal problem that would keep John Jones out of action. I think as long as he is healthy and available, the UFC will continue to put him in the cage and celebrate him as the light heavyweight champion and perhaps the greatest pound-for-pound fighter on the planet today.
Yeah, we were talking before about whether he picked a really great time or a really bad time to go ahead and do this. Because a bad time in the sense that with not a whole lot going on in terms of actual fights, it left people a little more free to focus on John Jones getting himself in trouble again. But in more ways, I think it was, if there's ever a good time to get arrested for DUI and shooting your gun off out the window of the car, maybe this is it. Because for one thing, the legal system has an incentive to get this stuff handled and avoid putting anybody in jail if you don't absolutely have to. So their incentive is like, let's please some of this stuff out, let's get it over and done with, and let's not bring people and add to the number of people incarcerated if we don't absolutely have to, especially right now. So it's good timing in that sense. But also, after that happened, then we had this whole crazy week of UFC 249. Will it happen? Won't it happen? Dana White getting calls from Disney telling him to shut the whole thing down. And that really overshadows a lot of this. And already, the whole John Jones DUI thing feels to me like it happened 3 months ago. So yeah. By the time the UFC starts back up again and we're all just excited to see some people fighting in a cage again, I don't think too many people will be thinking about it.
Yeah, in retrospect, it seemed like John Jones picked an absolutely amazing time to get picked up for DUI and shooting his gun off or whatever it was, because at the time that it happened, I guess we couldn't foresee how crazy the news cycle was about to get, not only with the everything surrounding UFC 249, but obviously with the Dana White sex tape extortion scandal that broke also in retrospect, what feels like a very, very short time before everything kind of got bowled over by all this UFC 249 news. I think we got a question about that coming up if we get to it, but yeah, good on you, John Jones, for choosing maybe the best time to get yourself arrested again.
That is not the message, Chad. That is not the message we want to be sending here.
You don't think we ought to be telling him he did a great job?
No. God damn it, Chad. Come on.
Anyway, great job, John Jones. Next question this week comes to us.
I'm going to have some things to say to you when call you on the phone.
This next question comes to us from Goldie Wilson, who writes, do you think Scotty Cokes has a private island on retainer as well, or maybe the Shark Tank or some abandoned warehouse in San Jose could possibly be converted to an empty arena studio home to get their product backed onto DAZN this summer? This is an interesting question. I mean, interesting just to think how Bellator will go about handling this shutdown potentially differently than how the UFC is going to do it. Like, Bellator came out pretty quickly and said, okay, we're going to postpone these events and we'll basically ride this out until the pandemic is over or the pandemic is contained to bring these sports back. You don't see Scotty Cokes out in the media in a way that I think would be very uncharacteristic for him if he did do it, but you don't see him out in the media talking about private islands and Indian casinos, even though Bellator does the majority of their stateside events at Indian casinos already. You don't see him trying to do this stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say, is the Bellator version of a private island just Thackerville, Oklahoma?
Yeah.
Because I don't know. I do wonder, like, wouldn't it be just so reflective of the MMA landscape if the UFC's like, we're jetting off to a private island, and if Bellator is like, we are going to push a barge just far enough out into the water. Like, what would be the Bellator version of the private island? I don't really know. But it does seem like
they found a landfill that is in a weird, disputed area between California and Oregon.
Yeah, it's like I remember once somebody explained to me in the town that I grew up that nearby there was a strip club and it seemed to be like in a weird area. And somebody once explained to me like, oh no, that area is this very small sliver, like right when like Los Angeles County ends and San Bernardino County begins, but it's not technically, they don't know exactly what city it's in. So basically if there's a call to the police there, the county sheriff will have to show up, which the response time is going to be longer for that. So that's why they felt like it was the most advantageous place for that strip club. Seems like maybe Bellator would be the type to go looking for the MMA regulatory equivalent of that. But even then, I mean, I think their situation with DAZN right now and DAZN's approach to this whole thing, that seems like it's a different situation going on than what we see with like ESPN and the UFC.
Yeah. Not that I want to get totally sidetracked here, but I just wanted to point out that I did very much enjoy it in Tiger King when Thackerville, Oklahoma made a surprise cameo.
Oh, hell yeah.
When two of the big cat creeps were going to start a new zoo and they decided that they were going to do it in Thackerville, Oklahoma, right by the Windstar Casino.
Man, can you imagine you'd be able to go check out a Bellator fight, go pet some tigers, and just at the end, between MMA cage fighting and captivity tiger petting, you'd be like, I don't know which to feel more conflicted about, man.
Yeah.
What a weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, given that it didn't have anything at all to do with MMA, Tiger King had very MMA energy pretty much all the way around.
Well, you got Jeff Lowe just afflictioned up out this motherfucker.
Yeah, he's looking like the CEO of every clothing company that sponsored an MMA fighter between 2001 and 2007. And also there's a dude running around with a big ass tap out tattoo in that show as well. So
yes, true.
You get the impression that there was some MMA stuff going on just underneath the surface.
I mean, it's refreshing to be able to watch a Netflix documentary that everybody's talking about and also have a whole lot of people involved who I feel like probably have strong opinions about who the pound for pound goat is.
Yeah. Yeah, they probably do. Plus, you know, John Jones was sitting at home being like, man, I've only got one cat. I could get like 300 more.
See, I think that that's the danger of something like Tiger King is how many, especially eccentric professional fighter types, once they realize that it's not as expensive as they might have assumed to buy a tiger, who knows what happens.
MMA also known for taking the wrong lessons, yes, from various things. Yeah. Next question this week comes from friend of the show, Kevin Sessia. He writes, hey guys, crazy planet right now, huh? Anyway, which fighter would you most and least like to be quarantined or on a road trip with? Also, which literary character would make the best MMA fighter, excluding Pepper Van Deen, of course? Man, you would be hard-pressed to find an MMA fighter that I feel like would be a real great quarantine partner.
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing I think the quarantine is teaching us all is that even the best of quarantine partners, you're still in a damn quarantine. You're still going to get sick of each other.
Yeah.
Yesterday, you know, my wife told me that the sound of me eating popcorn made her want to murder me. And I was like, well,
oh, wow. Things are getting heavy up there.
I don't know any other way to eat it. I'm sorry. If you know a better way, tell me about it. But damn it, I'm going to eat this popcorn. I mean, I don't know what to tell you.
You know who I could see being pretty good would be a guy like Damian Maia, because not only is he going to be like reasonable, you know, probably pretty quiet, keep to himself, but I bet he keeps a tidy house.
Yeah, I bet you're right.
Like, Damian Maia wouldn't leave his dishes all over the place. You know what I mean? Like, Damian Maia is going to be putting his dishes in the dishwasher for sure.
I also, though, I feel like I know that it initially just sounds bad. But if it came down to me and Nick Diaz smoking weed and playing around with nunchucks all day, I can imagine worse quarantine situations. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Like if in another world, an alternate reality.
Yeah, sure.
Where you had the time and space to just smoke weed with the Diaz brothers. I think it goes without saying Mike Perry and the poet Philip Baroni would probably be pretty bad.
Yeah. Well, it'd be entertaining for about a day and a half. And then you'd be like, hey, maybe I'll take my chances with this virus. How about that?
Yeah. Also, you got to think like a dude like John Jones, assuming he's not going out to shoot his gun off and drive around downtown Albuquerque. He's going to get like 24 hours into a quarantine and he's going to start trying to engage you in real deep conversations.
Okay.
You know what I mean? About the nature of the universe and whatnot.
I might be into that.
Like how could you ever prove that we don't live in the Matrix, bro?
I don't know if I can. Stuff. I don't know if I can, Chad. Also, as for the literary character that would make the best MMA fighter, I mean, I don't know how much we want to stretch the definition of literary, but is Jack Reacher basically unbeatable?
I mean, what about Thanos? Thanos shows up from the Marvel Universe.
Well, shit. I see, now you're really stretching the definition of literary.
I mean, I don't even know if he could make weight, though. Like, he looks like he's rolling around way above the heavyweight limit.
Yeah, plus we're not going to let you bring in a crazy glove with a bunch of stones on it, man. That's not – no athletic commission is going to give you the signature on the tape on the wrist for that one. Like, we're going to have to
– I don't know, man.
Do something about
that. Show me
in
the rules where I can't bring the spirit stones or whatever they are. Show me where it says that in the rules.
Spirit stones?
I'm telling you, what were they called?
The only problem is that Jack Reacher is going to be out here trying to do like some small joint manipulation or something, like breaking your fingers one at a time to get you to talk. And, you know, that flies in the face of the unified rules.
Jason Bourne would be out here winning UFC titles, having no idea how he even did it. Right. I don't know, man. I've never trained a day in my life, but here I am beating up Anderson Silva, winning the UFC middleweight championship.
See, now, damn it. Now I'm way too into that idea.
Next question this week comes to us from Roland Bleasy, who writes, who is MMA's biggest bust? Dude who Dana White called the next Anderson Silva? Uriah Hall after all and the all-time great KO of Adam Sella on Tough? James Toney? Discourse.
Well, James Toney, I feel like, at least on the UFC side and on just generally the MMA side, everybody kind of got what they wanted out of that, didn't they?
Yeah, and it's James not like the UFC brought James Toney in and was like, James Toney seems like we could really make something out of him. Like that, like they knew exactly what they were doing to send him out there to fight Randy Couture, man. Like that was like a foregone conclusion.
Yeah, he wanted a paycheck. He got it. The UFC wanted to be able to have a boxer bring a little bit of different kind of attention, but also to see him lose and to be an opportunity to remind people that maybe MMA fighters know some shit that other people don't know. And everybody got to do their stuff in the Randy Couture James Toney fight, you might say.
Yeah. What was it? Remind me of the name of the guy who won an early season of The Ultimate Fighter without having any professional fights.
Are you thinking of Amir Sadala?
Yeah, Amir Sadala. I mean, not necessarily that he was a bust, but like he wins The Ultimate Fighter without any professional fights. And then it puts the UFC in a really weird position. And this was back like when it kind of meant something to win The Ultimate Fighter, right? Like this was back when guys who won The Ultimate Fighter were kind of going on to be capital G guys in the sport. And then like Sadala comes along, seemed like a great dude, but he wins The Ultimate Fighter with no fights. And then like they literally had to make a rule that like, okay, you have to have at least a few professional fights to get on The Ultimate Fighter. Because once he was the Tough champion, then he's in the UFC and matchmakers had to go around like trying to find people that he could have a competitive fight with, just because, again, it was a different time back in those days. You didn't have a lot of people floating around the UFC roster that only had a couple of fights.
Yeah, I guess it depends like how we're thinking of bust, because somebody like Amir Sadala, he won The Ultimate Fighter, but also if you win The Ultimate Fighter and you get in the UFC that way, it's not like the UFC feels like they're spending so much damn money on you that they need you to be super good. I would think like, if you want to think of it in terms of like how much did the UFC spend and how hyped were they and then did not get at all what they expected. I got to say somebody like maybe Mirko Krokop, who had himself a great MMA career all the way around. But do you remember when the UFC first got him and brought him over from Pride, it was like, okay, yeah, we're going to be grooming him for the title shot, and then he's going to get this title shot against Randy Couture, and it's going to be great, and we're going to do big business with it. And he just never really materialized into what they, I think, hoped he would be in the UFC.
In the UFC, maybe, but man, it's pretty harsh to judge Mirko Krokop a bust. Yeah. Like, the guy was in one of the, what up to the, that point was probably the greatest MMA fight of all time when he fought Fedor Emelianenko. And he's one of the few guys to win two Grand Prix tournaments, like 10 years apart or whatever he did it, because he won a Pride Grand Prix tournament. And then he won the, Ryzen Grand Prix tournament, I think, in like 2016. So, you know, Krokop, you could make the argument Krokop never won a conventional major championship. But he also, like, he was pretty goddamn good.
He was. But you look at, like, the stretch of his career that is by far the worst is the time he spent in the UFC. Like, more losses there than any other time. And especially the way the UFC clearly had a plan here. When they brought him over, it was like, okay, we're going to have him beat up Eddie Sanchez in his first UFC fight just so he looks fucking awesome and introduce people that don't know yet how badass Krokop is to all the stuff that he can do. And then he'll beat up Gabriel Gonzaga and it'll be title shot time, and instead he goes out there and gets Krokopped by Gonzaga, one of the still like biggest shocks, I think, especially in the heavyweight division. And then after that, just never quite found his footing. And I remember even he was saying stuff along those lines. I remember interviewing him once where he was like, I owe it to the UFC to like get my shit together because they've treated me well and they expected more out of me, and I'm going to do it. I'm going to get my shit together and I'm really going to show them that they made the right decision in getting me. And, you know, he had some bright spots here or there, but just never totally turned into, I think, like what the blue chip heavyweight they thought he was going to be.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's one of the things that complicates this conversation is that there's a lot of different ways to think about an MMA bust. You know, like you could even look at a guy like Kevin Jackson real early in the UFC's history, like a guy who came in with bona fide Olympic wrestling skills, like should have been one of the best of that day, like in a very good athlete. But at the same time, like he goes out there and gets armbarred a couple times, gets armbarred by Frank Shamrock. And like, that's kind of all she wrote for that guy. Like he never really caught on in MMA when he was a guy who probably had the skills to do really well. I feel like the sports history is littered with people like that who, you know, had the athleticism, had the skills, had a really good base to work from. And then just for whatever reason could never put it together or never wanted to put it together.
Yeah.
All right, next question this week comes to us from Joel Sweeney, who writes, as the sport evolves, we've seen techniques that were once thought impractical come back into fashion. Is there a technique that you've been waiting for someone to pull off in a cage? If you had to guess, what obscure technique will have a breakout year in 2021? My guess would be the Diego Sanchez stunner. Like, this is an impossible question, right?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's the techniques that I would love to see people start pulling off, but then the fact that they're not probably means that there's a good reason you're not going to be able to go out there and pull them off. Like, do you remember for a while when, and some people will still do it, but like when some people fell a little bit too in love with make Imanari roll into heel hook or leg lock attacks. And it was like playing somebody on a video game where they would just keep on trying it, even though it doesn't ever quite come together the way you think it will. I don't know. I mean, I'd kind of like to see like some of the crazier – I mean, maybe this is just me as a jiu-jitsu nerd, but I'd like to see some of the crazier variations on like open guard that you see or that over the years people have popularized in jiu-jitsu really be able to work for MMA. But it's tough when it's, you know, no-gi and against somebody who might just decide, you know what, I'm going to take a few steps back and not even fuck with all the weird shit you're trying to do off your back right now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it would be awesome to see some more of the really like flashy, big karate, kung fu, kickboxing moves sort of become more effective. You know what I mean? We've already seen the rise of these recent fighters, you know, like Wonderboy Thompson, who do a lot of traditional karate inspired techniques that were probably left behind early in the evolution of mixed martial arts as stuff that we didn't think was practical and didn't think that would work, frankly, when we saw all these early UFCs when, you know, guys like Hoist Gracie and Ken Shamrock and to a certain extent Pat Smith were sort of like beating up these traditional martial arts instructors. A lot of that stuff got left behind, and now we've evolved to the point where you've got athletes and technicians who are able to actually implement some of that stuff. Like, it would be awesome to see it get real crazy and, you know, maybe you get some five animal kung fu red sash owners who are actual like you know, bona fide high level MMA fighters.
Or bring in, get the drunken boxer kung fu style in here. That's some shit I can get behind.
There you go. Kind of like when George St. Pierre brought that drunk guy in to train on The Ultimate Fighter. Do you remember this?
When Still one of the best Ultimate Fighter moments ever.
Yeah, and he's basically like he's three sheets to the wind, but he's basically kicking everybody's ass.
Yeah, and I love though that before he brought that guy in, George had like warned the teammates, like, okay, look, this is my friend. He seems a little unconventional. All I'll say is if you respect him, he'll respect you. And you're like, well, that's ominous. That's not really what I wanted to hear right now, but okay, here we go.
All right, this will be the last question this week. This might be a good one to transition into our round one, Ben. This one comes from Sean Simpson. He writes, we know that Dana is going to Dana, but do you think the Fertittas would have been pushing forward to hold an event during a pandemic? Please discourse, good sirs. I feel like this is kind of an interesting question because on one hand, while the Fertittas love money, on the other hand, I just don't know that the UFC was in the same kind of financial situation that it was in when the Fertittas were in charge. And I guess that is if you fall in line with the speculation that the reason the UFC is trying to put on these events was in order to get up over 40 broadcasted events on ESPN and get it $750 million in licensing fees and get the licensing fee that it would get specifically just for UFC 249 from the ESPN broadcasters. I don't know, Ben, what do you think? Would the Fertittas somehow have had better sense, or would they have just kind of handled this the same way?
You know, it's not like we got a whole lot of glimpses of the Fertittas going, this will make us money, but maybe it's not the most prudent thing. Right. Especially there towards the end, especially when it seemed like they'd reached a point where they're like, okay, we sunk a lot of money into this thing back when it wasn't clear if it was going to be successful, and now it is successful, and now's the time for us to start getting some of our money back. I don't know if we have a whole lot of evidence other than just maybe in our memories, the Fertitta brothers become a little bit more sane and dignified in comparison to Dana White's wilder moments. But I don't know if we have really too much evidence we can point to and be like, see, here's where the Fertittas were like, yeah, sure, this will make us money, but at what cost?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree with that. We also didn't see them in well, there's never been a crisis exactly like this one, but we never really saw them in a comparable crisis management situation in their UFC ownership days. So I guess I really have no idea how they would react. I think that they would be able to make decisions a little bit faster. You know, with UFC 249, it basically took a public relations firestorm that reached the highest levels of Disney and ESPN to reach out and tell Dana White, hey, man, we're not going to do this. Like, at least with the Fertitta brothers, I think you would have a much more direct line between Dana White and the top upper echelon owners of the UFC who they, you know, they would have been texting throughout the whole damn thing. So they might have been able to reach a decision much quicker. I just don't know what that decision would have been.
Yeah.
All right, well, that's going to do it for listener mail this week. If you have a question, comment, or concern that you would like to air to the podcast in future weeks, you guys know how to do it. You go to the website, comainevent.com, and click the link in the top right-hand corner of the screen that says email the podcast. That'll get you in touch with us. Keep those emails coming. We're going to need some listener mail moving forward, at least over the next few weeks when there's not a lot of ongoing fight stuff to happen. So send us in your cards and messages. While you're there, go ahead and sign up for the Breakfast of Champions newsletter. That comes out every Friday morning to catch you up on the news and notes that we miss when we're not recording the podcast. Stuff always happens. News always breaks. We try to put a humorous spin on it. We would love to tell you it's funny. And if you don't like it, it's really easy to unsubscribe. As for right now, though, we're going to go ahead and get started with round number one.
Chad, you know what I'd be thinking if I were stuck home during this whole quarantine? There's no MMA fights going on. There's just nothing but doubt and sadness everywhere you look. You know what I'd
Would
be doing?
Would you be thinking maybe I can think of a different way to eat popcorn?
Well, that's if you can think of a bunch of different ways to eat popcorn, I'd love to hear about them. No, I was thinking instead, one thing you could do is you could get down with the CME Patreon and unlock a whole lot of extra content that we're just providing for you. That's, you know, you need a connection to the outside world so it doesn't feel like you're just going crazy by yourself in your house all the time. The CME Weekly Live Chat goes down every Wednesday, live-ish chat. That's the way you can get in touch with all the other CME podcast listeners, with us. We're all in there. We're having a good time. Anything goes. You get in there for only $1 a month, Chad. That's hardly even money. It's just like pennies. And in exchange, you get human interaction. It's a pretty good deal. Plus, you go up to the next Patreon level, the $5 tier. Then you get access to the weekly CME Power Hour, a whole other podcast every Friday, especially during this time. That's a good opportunity to sit down, maybe with a ice-cold, frosty soda pop or two, and join the CME as we go back and we watch classic fights, some that are classic for good reasons and some that are classic for other reasons.
Indeed.
Then you jump all the way to the top tier, the $10 a month patron, and that gets you access to all the aforementioned stuff, but also the CME Movie Club, where right now, according to our voting, it looks like Foxcatcher has a pretty strong lead on Killing Them Softly. We'll wait to see how that one plays out. In any event, you get down with the CME Patreon, patreon.com/co-main-event, and you also get to have the warm, cozy feeling that comes with knowing that you are supporting this here independent podcast and keeping the discourse completely unfettered.
Ben, they say that pandemics change the world. And here in mixed martial arts, I don't know if anything changed. I don't know how much we learned, but I feel like a lot of people's attitudes got cast in sharper relief here over the last couple of weeks in and around the plans, the madcap plans, I would say, to try to keep UFC 249 together. We saw Dana White in as stringent and strident a leadership role as we've ever seen him. We saw some back and forth from the American Boxing and Combat Sports Commission. We saw Disney and ESPN ultimately come in and pull the plug. We saw fighters' reactions to that. We saw fans' reactions to that. We saw the media's reaction to that. We even saw some MMA managers' reactions to that. Let's start with the man in charge himself, Dana White. Ben, do you feel like we learned anything or we got a view of anything into the character or leadership style of Dana White around UFC 249 that was different than anything we had seen before?
I don't know if I would say it was different. I think it was a lot of what we have come to expect from Dana White, but more so, and maybe thrown into a sharper relief when you compare it to what everybody else was doing and saying and thinking at the time.
Yeah. For me, it was like we found out that some people weren't kidding around about this stuff. You know what I mean? Like we've seen his Dana White's show must go on attitude over a long period of time. We've seen him react to much less serious public shifts of consciousness and public ideas and things like that. We've seen him clash against the culture in various ways over his tenure as UFC president. But this was a moment where I have to admit, despite the fact that this wasn't really out of character for him, I have to admit that there were times when I was like, oh, word? Really? Like, even during the middle of a pandemic, huh? Like, you weren't kidding around about your shit. Like, you're going to come out here and keep it this real, even as hundreds of thousands of people worldwide fall ill and indeed die. So to me, it was just sort of like a reinforcement of the idea that like he's not kidding around. He's not playing a character. Like this is how he's going to be all the time, and not even the global pandemic will like make him act any different than the way he normally acts.
Are you saying that what you found out is that Dana White was really about that life?
I guess so, man. Like in the face of world-changing events, he's still just going to keep doing Dana White stuff all the time. And maybe in some ways you got to give him credit for it. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I don't know if credit's the right word, but it is, I guess maybe it's instructive to see like that's one of the things I guess that people really like about Dana White is they go, oh, that guy is not pretending. Like that guy is not walking a corporate line. He's telling you exactly what he thinks. And the people who like Dana White, they love that about him. Like, yeah, Dana, tell her what it is. Yeah, that's awesome. And that is kind of in line with the thing that they like about the idea of this renegade sports promoter who is not going to play it safe the way the commissioner of the NFL or somebody has to. Like Dana White's going to be like, I don't see why we can't get out here and have some fights, you bunch of wimps. And they're going, yeah, like that's exactly what I want out of my fight promoter. And so maybe there is something weirdly reassuring about seeing that even in this kind of situation, he's still going to be that guy. And yet, we talked about this a little bit on the Power Hour on Friday. You do wonder if the people at ESPN and Disney are also going, maybe this bear's keeping a closer eye on.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we have discussed as this story has unfolded and then ultimately fell apart was just sort of like how ridiculous the effort to keep UFC 249 intact eventually became, right? Like, you tried to move it to the United Arab Emirates, and then the United Arab Emirates was pretty much like, no, you cannot do it here because of our growing concerns over the coronavirus. So you tried to move it to Florida because that was the commission in the United States that you felt like you could get the easiest time from. And then Florida essentially declared a statewide shelter in place order. So even the Florida Athletic Commission was like, nah, man, sorry, you can't even do it here. And then, you know, you lost Habib because he was stuck in Dagestan, frankly, because he tried to go to the United Arab Emirates because that's where he thought the event was going to be. Then you lose Rose Namajunas because of reportedly a couple of deaths in her family due to COVID-19. And then you try to move the event to California, one of the worst hit states by this current pandemic, one of the states that has enacted some of the most stringent social distancing orders and recommendations, and try to do it out there in Lemoore at Tachi Palace, where they don't really even have a commission. Would have been the first time in the history of the UFC, I think, that the UFC would have tried to act as its own commission while doing an event in America. And eventually you had these big wigs from Disney and ESPN call in the big guns to get this thing called off. But like, at no point did it seem like anybody in a decision-making position at the UFC look at all of this evidence and say, hey man, you know what? Maybe this isn't a great idea. So I guess we learned that too, that like, once the course has been plotted, there's almost no way without outside intervention to get the UFC to change its course. But, and it took, as you said, like Disney and ESPN coming in.
But don't you think that that was something we kind of knew already? Dana White has made it very clear and has kind of bragged about it at times that once he makes up his mind to do something, nobody is going to talk him out of it. And that he seems to see it as a great strength of character. Like, that's a sign of how resolute he is in his decision making. Another way to look at it is that that's a person who is not capable of processing new information. And we heard about it a lot back when the UFC was taking heat for the Greg Hardy stuff and how it was handling Greg Hardy in the UFC and, you know, putting Greg Hardy on the same card with somebody who had been a victim very recently of domestic violence, and the way it was approaching all that. And Dana White kept saying over and over again, like, hey, I don't care what anybody thinks. Once I make up my mind, I'm sure that I'm right. And that's what he was saying too about this coronavirus stuff, is that one thing I know for sure is that I'm not wrong about this. And yet every time we heard him give some kind of take on how you operate during coronavirus, how and why you keep going as a sports promoter, it just seemed like he did not understand at all what he was dealing with. Like, all his comments from the, like, I don't give a shit about coronavirus moments, to the, you can't hide from this stuff, something's going to get you anyway, you know, we all got to go sometime type approach to it. Like, every time he started to talk about it, it seemed like, you just don't understand what you're up against. You don't understand what this actually is. And so I can see why for some people it seems like, yeah, you like a resolute leader who's going to make a decision and then not waver, not second guess himself. But then if that means you can't learn anything new, like if you can't have somebody explain to you that you're wrong about your approach to this thing and here's why, and like if the here's why can't get through your head, then you have a problem.
Yeah, I guess the only thing I would say to that is that it feels like what we saw here the last couple of weeks was in some ways a fundamentally different situation than like booking fights for Greg Hardy or moving a UFC event to California after John Jones tests positive, or like even trying to get Jeremy Stevens out of jail in Minnesota so he can fight that night on a random UFC fight night card. I guess what we learned is that like that kind of thinking extends to major worldwide earth changing, culture changing events, which I still think, man, whew, that's some shit right there. That is still some shit. Ben, do you think that the relationship between Disney/ESPN and the UFC changed at all during this?
You know, hard to say, but at least you see the first thing resembling any sort of cracks in that relationship, right? We've talked about this before, about how the pattern for the UFC is usually you start off with a new TV partner and everything is great. Everybody's in love and, oh my God, this one is so much better than all the other previous TV partners and they treat us so well and we're going to treat them well and everybody loves it. And that's how it's gone before with Spike TV, with Fox, and now with ESPN. They've had nothing but good things to say about each other. And then you have this situation where Dana White has to be called by the higher ups and told like, hey, don't go through with this. And then even when he announces that we're not going through with it, he doesn't really hesitate to lay the blame at that door. Like he says, hey, I don't crack under this pressure. Other people crack to it. And the other people seems to mean executives at Disney and ESPN here. And so it does seem like if we haven't seen any big rifts, that might be the first small rift that we've seen. And typically by the time they get to the end of these deals in the UFC's history, people feel differently about each other than they did at the very beginning.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. What about the way this unfolded with Dana White and the media and MMA fans and ultimately how fighters reacted to it also? Because, you know, we've talked before about how the media is a convenient scapegoat for people like Dana White, people like his friend, the president of the United States. And we saw some of that come to the fore here during the UFC 249 debacle, where basically Dana White was like, he said, I literally told them to go fuck themselves. And his attitude that reporters were quote unquote scumbags because they would try to screw up all of his hard work to put on UFC 249 during a pandemic by reporting the details of how he was trying to go about that. And then when UFC 249 finally got canceled, there was some backlash from people in the media saying that other people had quote unquote cheered the cancellation of UFC 249. It seemed like some fighters got upset about it. It seemed like the UFC would probably very much like that to be the narrative. What do you make of any and all of that foolishness?
Well, it is some foolishness, I think. I guess in a way, I'm not that surprised by it because the media is always kind of an easy scapegoat for stuff, right? Like whenever you're just – especially when the news is bad, when just the facts of the situation is bad, then it's easy to blame the people who are telling you the bad news. That's a natural kind of reaction. And it seems like with this one, Dana White really set himself in opposition to the media early on, like was just – really adamant about how he was going to keep all this a secret. He's not telling the media anything at all. And so then when the media finds out anyway, and then when that news is not well received by people in positions of power, it's easy to turn back and see like, see, this is why you don't want the media to know what your plans are. But then if your plans have to be kept an absolute secret, then maybe that should be the first sign that they aren't a great idea. If you can't have anybody know what you're doing, it usually doesn't mean that you're doing anything super awesome. So I mean, I understand, I guess, like some of that initial backlash. The thing I don't really understand is I don't understand the whole thought process. If you think that the media just wants to ruin these fights just for what? Just for fun? For something to do? Because like, our colleague at The Athletic, Fernanda Prates, wrote a really good column this weekend explaining like, hey, we wanted these fights, not only because we're all fans and we wanted to actually see them, but also because it's in our self-interest as keeping our jobs going. Like we write about the fights. If there are no fights, there's nothing to write about. There's not as many people reading the websites. It's bad for the financial health of our employers, just kind of across the board in the MMA media. If there's no fights going on, it would have been much better and easier for us if those fights went on. But it's also part of our job to tell the truth and to, when the situation is a bad situation, to call it out for what it is. And I can understand maybe people didn't want to hear that, but that doesn't mean that it's not true. Just because it's unwelcome news for you, that in itself does not mean that we're wrong.
Yeah. And this might have been another instance where we should maybe be glad that MMA doesn't have a more obvious or high profile place in the mainstream sports landscape, because around the cancellation of UFC 249, you had a lot of people come out, like Ali Abdelaziz came out and said, blamed the Democratic Party.
Okay.
For killing UFC 249. You had, Abe Kawa come out and, throw some shade at the World Health Organization.
Okay, sure. Why not?
For the cancellation of UFC 249.
Anybody but the UFC, apparently.
You had Bilal Muhammad come out and say something to the effect of, this time the weaklings won. You had a lot of people reacting to this in ways that I think would have made much bigger news if these were all high-profile individuals in the sport of professional football or professional basketball. Let's say, like, if Steph Curry came out and said, well, this is the Democrats' fault, I think you would have a larger story on your hands than in MMA, where a lot of this stuff just kind of, it either rolls off the back of our shoulders, or we shrug it off and say, well, you know, MMA fighters are going to act like MMA fighters.
Well, but this one for Dana White, I feel like especially a lot of people, a lot of news outlets that don't normally pay any attention to Dana White or the UFC or MMA in general, were starting to take notice. Like, there was a column in the AP about Dana White. They were throwing different levels of shade at him on NPR, both in, like, you know, Morning Edition, and then even like joking about him on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me over the weekend. Like, that's what we talked about before, is the downside to having the spotlight to yourself when all the other sports are stopped going, is that it's also easier for people to see if you're up to no good. And yeah, Dana White was in the news as like the lone guy, aside from Vince McMahon, basically trying to push forward and act like the pandemic is no big deal. And so I think a lot of people who wouldn't normally notice anything the UFC does were noticing that.
Yeah. All right, well, let's go ahead and do our Are You Fucking Kidding Me's before we wrap up this round. I will do mine first, Ben, because you just mentioned it. This week, my Are You Fucking Kidding Me goes out to Paul Newbery from the Associated Press, who otherwise wrote a pretty good editorial about Dana White's senseless push to put on UFC 249, but also apparently couldn't resist dipping into the bag of cliched, old-ass mainstream sports writer insults about MMA in general and in the process. Here's a couple of quotes from this AP editorial, the headline of which was, "What's wrong with UFC ruler Dana White?" He refers to Dana White as the UFC's undisputed ruler, who is determined to put others in harm's way to provide his Roman gladiator style of alleged entertainment, even if it means taking it to the islands. He also refers to MMA in this article as a, quote, pseudo sport, which has become wildly popular for no apparent reason beyond the bloodlust of its fan base.
Oh, wow.
You fucking kidding me? We still got to do this? We still got to do this stuff in the year of our Lord 2020, when we are otherwise writing a completely fair and well-intentioned article about the UFC's crazy attempt to put on UFC 249. We really got to call it a pseudo sport and say that we're a bunch of knuckle draggers out here with our bloodlust and our Roman gladiator style entertainment. You fucking kidding me?
Fucking kidding me?
Come on, Paul Newbery.
But Chad, are you fucking kidding me? I'm over there. I'm on the Twitters, just scrolling through, trying to distract myself from everything else that's going on, hoping maybe to see, you know, some cute animal pictures, maybe video of somebody trying to jump a ramp on their bike and hurting themselves. You know, good social media content, in other words. And what do I see instead? Israel Adesanya and John Jones still picking at each other, still just tweeting insults at each other. You guys, come on. Not now. Not now. Can't you just see, like, maybe this is not the right time for this shit? It was all like harmless fun and games before, even though it was still getting a little cloying, a little bit annoying. You guys were overdoing it a little bit. Now we're in the middle of a damn pandemic and we're still over here just tweeting shade at each other, two guys in different weight classes. Are you fucking kidding me? Read the room.
Are you kidding me? That's going to do it for round number one. We'll be right back with round number two.
Chad, I'm going to try to hit you with a little bit of silver lining during all this about MMA being shut down, UFC 249 being called off, all this stuff. Once we do finally get back to the point when we feel like we can safely have fights again, and Dana White has promised that the UFC will be the first sport back, so maybe we'll just plunge once again into the discussion about whether or not it is safe to have fights when the UFC decides to do it. But maybe this is all just one big reset button, Chad. Maybe now we can all take a second, take a breath, collect ourselves, and go, oh yeah, let's get back to making Tony Ferguson versus Khabib Nurmagomedov and forget all about this whole silly interim lightweight title idea. What do you think? Is that a realistic hope?
You don't think trying to book Tony Ferguson against Khabib Nurmagomedov again would trigger some manner of like super volcano that would destroy the entire Western Hemisphere? I mean, pandemic was kind of bad enough, right?
Listen, if this is what it takes to have an asteroid collide with the Earth and wipe out all of humanity, then fine. Let's go ahead and find out that that's what's going to happen, because we can't live in fear, Chad. We can't be like, okay, let's not book the fight because we're afraid of the asteroid. Is that how you want to live?
No, I guess you make a good point. I guess that this should be the hill that the entire human race dies on. Yep. The entire organized human civilization put into harm's way, just on the outside chance that we finally get to see Ferguson versus Nurmagomedov.
Just watching those two guys duke it out amid the ashes of humanity, I feel pretty good about it. Come on, though.
Yeah, only the cockroaches will be around to watch Ferguson versus Nurmagomedov.
Now, I believe, you know, Khabib doesn't compete during Ramadan, right? That's his thing?
That's correct.
Now, just from Googling Ramadan, it seems like this year Ramadan's going to run through from like, you know, late April, late May, and then maybe if we're coming back in the summer, I've heard Khabib talk about September, stuff like that. If we've already waited this long and we've already gone through this, you know, fight booked, then pulled off, and then, you know, maybe a plan B tried to put together in the last moments, couldn't we just, even if we have to wait until September, couldn't we just decide like, all right, that is the thing to do? Because the whole interim lightweight title thing, in situations like this, I always have to ask, what's the interim? Like, what is the interim period defined by? Is it just that we're waiting until we have a convenient date? Because it's not like somebody's hurt or somebody's suspended or something like that. It's just like a matter of getting everybody's schedules to line up so you can book the fight, and for there being a pandemic dying down enough that you can actually schedule the fight and get it to come off as planned. I don't understand why, if our short notice plans were interrupted anyway, why wouldn't we just go back to the original plan A, Tony versus Khabib?
Yeah, I mean, I assume that we would. I think that once all this stuff gets sorted out and we get the sport back together, that's probably the move, as long as everyone's, you know, healthy and available to compete. I think we'll probably look back on the notion of Tony Ferguson against Justin Gaethje for an interim title as kind of like a fever dream that we all had. It felt like we were going to have that fight for about 5 minutes, just long enough to make a poster. And then we decided that, no, we're not going to do this event. Probably hit the reset button on the whole thing. I would assume that Ferguson versus Nurmagomedov is going to be the move, because I think anything else would kind of make people be like, WTF, UFC? Like, why are we messing around with this even more than we have to? But at the same time, there's still a lot of unknowns, a lot of ins and outs, a lot of it, I think, is going to depend on the timeline of when everybody is able to get back and when this thing actually resumes. And to that end, Ben, I have mentioned in the past over on the Power Hour or other Patreon properties, the specter of Conor McGregor kind of looming out there over in Ireland, doing his public service announcements about coronavirus, every now and then tweeting something weird about China. What are the odds, if we have a lengthy delay in the MMA schedule and the UFC looks at this dead period in the schedule and is like, oh man, we lost a ton of money here now that the scumbags prevented us from putting on UFC 249 and we all had to take a time out. What are the odds that they decide to move forward, Ben, with the fight that is probably the biggest moneymaker that it has on the board and try to put Conor McGregor into another fight with Khabib Nurmagomedov? Is that possible?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to conclude that anything is possible, especially the more money it stands to make, the more possible it becomes. But I don't know. I mean, it seems to me like there are a lot of fights you could put Conor McGregor in and make a whole lot of money right now. Like Conor McGregor versus Justin Gaethje, you can go ahead and you can do that one and you can make a whole bunch of money. Conor McGregor versus Nate Diaz 3, you can put that one together, you can make a whole bunch of money. I don't know why you would take this situation that makes so much sense as far as the actual competitive rankings style approach to fight booking and just say, you know what, we had told everybody for months and months that this was finally going to happen, that this was the fight that absolutely needed to happen. And then through nothing happening, through just like an interruption in our schedule, we completely changed the plan. And I mean, it's not like it would be completely unthinkable for the UFC to do something like that, even if it wasn't the smartest move. But I just don't see what you turn around and tell people, like, other than, hey, we would like to make a lot of your money, please. Like, what do you tell people, like, is your reasoning for why we'd go ahead and do Khabib versus Conor now?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure reasoning has ever been a real high priority, perhaps now less than ever in the UFC. It seems like if they want to put a fight on, they're just going to do it and they'll say something. And if people, you know, whether or not people buy it is kind of beside the point as far as they're concerned. You know what I would do if at all possible, given my druthers, when this thing gets back together, not only to put together a super card, but also to cover your ass in a way, wouldn't it be cool to do Khabib versus Tony for the title and Gaethje versus McGregor on the same damn card, man? Put them all, bring them all together in case something happens. You've got two other guys willing to step in and make this fight or make a fight instead of, you know, getting into this mad scramble that we had around UFC 249. And frankly, the other times that we've tried to book Tony Ferguson against Khabib Nurmagomedov. Now, maybe it's a little bit of a dangerous plan, Ben, because the last time Khabib Nurmagomedov, Tony Ferguson, and Conor McGregor were all even in the same city, Conor McGregor threw a hand truck through the window of a charter bus, and we got ourselves into a whole different snafu around UFC 223. But I still think that's the move. Put both these fights on the same card, not only to make an awesome card, but also as a little bit of insurance for you as the UFC.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be great for fans. And especially one of the things that we have all been talking about is that with this break, when the UFC does come back and with an incentive to really put together cards that are going to make it a lot of money, will we see stacked cards? Because everybody's been off, everybody's ready to compete, everybody's hungry to compete. But then we've also heard in the past that Conor McGregor has it in his deal that he doesn't have to share pay-per-view space with anybody who's also getting pay-per-view points, which is typically any other champion. So I don't know. The UFC, I think, would probably prefer to spread those out and, like, why muscle up on one big card that's going to do monster numbers if we feel like we can do really, really, really strong numbers with two separate cards. I think that, especially with the UFC's pay-per-view guarantee coming from ESPN, that's an incentive not to stack the cards too heavily. I don't know. As much as I love the idea, I don't think that's any chance that we actually get it.
Well, we're going to be talking about stacked cards and how the sport is going to look and what fights we may or may not be looking forward to the most by the end of the year coming up in round three. But Ben, before we do that, it's time for tips for the well-rounded fight fan. Give the kids at home your tip. What's your well-rounded fight fan tip for this week, Ben?
You know, Chad, been stuck in the house for a long time, very limited human contact outside of members of my immediate family. And you know what I went ahead and jumped on the App Store and re-downloaded? Words with Friends, my man.
Wow, a real flashback.
Yeah. And let me tell you something. They seem to have added a whole lot of bells and whistles that I don't care for. So in classic old guy fashion, I just downloaded what they refer to now as classic Words with Friends. And even then, they added a whole lot of features I don't exactly care for, but you can ignore them well enough. And so for the first time since, like, I don't know, 2014 or something, I'm back on Words with Friends. And I guess I'm just saying it's a good way to help, you know, get you a little bit of connection with people outside of your immediate vicinity. Feel like you have something, you're engaged in something throughout the day. There's some contact between you and the outside world. And if any CME listeners want to come catch these hands on Words with Friends, Ben Folks is on there and he awaits your challenge.
Wow.
That's your tip for the well-rounded fight fan.
It's a tip and also a challenge.
It's a little bit of everything, you know?
I like this. I like that you went flashback and recommended a phone app from like 7 years ago.
Yeah.
And your tip for the well-rounded fight fan.
Yeah, it's the first time in a long time that I've played. You know what? A real stinging blow, though, was that I tried to start a game with my mom and she declined. Just turned me down flat. And I was like, wow, all right. That hurts. That hurts a little bit, but okay.
Wow. What'd you do to piss her off?
I don't know. Maybe she just felt like I would not be a competitive match for her, which probably true. She did not take a break from this game. I can tell you that. Like, my mom has been playing it straight since like 2014. So she's pretty good.
She's been putting in that work.
That's right.
For 7 years straight. Yeah, I wouldn't want to mess with that. I wouldn't mess with that at all. I'd consider myself lucky, Ben.
Yeah, maybe for the best.
All right. Well, this week, Ben, my tip for the well-rounded fight fan, if you're sitting at home, you're trying to figure out something to watch on the television, maybe you are trying to escape, so to speak, from the current state of world affairs. You want to watch something a little bit light, maybe something you don't want to, you don't have to sink your entire psychological, emotional investment into. Go ahead and watch The English Game over on Netflix. It's a 6-part limited series, kind of about the formation of modern soccer across the pond there in England, where the game was still considered a gentleman's game back in those days. Being paid to play was explicitly illegal. And then you had these blue-collar teams from the mill towns of England kind of come into the league and take the world by storm. If you like something along the lines of like a Downton Abbey, you will probably enjoy The English Game. It was actually created by the same guy, Julian Fellowes, who did Downton Abbey. But you can go ahead and watch yourself a light, pleasing, entertaining show, 6 episodes long, with some English guys running around, kicking a ball around. The English Game.
So this is like a dramatized thing, not like a documentary?
No, it's a drama.
Okay. All right.
And you get to watch a lot of guys in silly late 1800s soccer uniforms run around and play the game.
Oh, I know you love that.
Yeah, it's a big draw for me. All right, that's going to do it for round number two. We will be right back with round number three. Well, Ben, the fights are on pause for now, but Dana White tells us Fight Island is real. The infrastructure is being built as we speak, and he is going to get the UFC back in action as soon as he can, as soon as humanly possible. Dana White says we'll be doing fights out at an anonymous island in the middle of some body of water, flying people in from all over the world and putting these fights on, man. You jacked? You pumped? You excited for this?
Okay, wait a minute. So we're going to use Fight Island as a way to just come back before the rest of sports can come back? Is that the idea?
I mean, doesn't that kind of seem like his intention when he did this interview with Brett Okamoto that we talked about during the Power Hour, where he both announced that UFC 249 was off, but also seemed completely unrepentant? And completely as though this had not given him any pause. He had not learned anything. He had not stopped to think about any of these actions. Fight Island is real, baby. We're going to go ahead and push forward with it, in his words, as soon as we can, ASAP.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, I have questions, I guess. Especially maybe it's just the nature of Fight Island itself as this promise where it feels like Dana White is just saying stuff, right? Like saying, like, Ivan Island, we're going to be ready to go. The infrastructure is being built. Don't even worry about it. We're going to be doing fights on a private island, baby. Like, it just sounds a little bit like a weird fantasy. And then if it actually does come to fruition, I guess my question is, are you just flying fighters from all over the world into Fight Island? Like, doesn't that start to seem unrealistic, like financially, just like the cost of doing stuff like that?
I mean, I was starting to wonder how we were even going to turn a profit on UFC 249. What with basically trying to be our own commission and move everything to Lemoore, California. And then on top of that, we're going to try to rent a private island. It seems like we are just spitballing in a way. Like, we're out here in uncharted waters trying to make these things come off, no matter what the risk and no matter what the cost. And that is a lot of the uncertainty for me around this Fight Island idea. Do you give Fight Island a better or worse chance of actually coming off, of actually becoming a reality than UFC 249 itself?
Yes. Yeah, I'll give it that. Just because it's
a better chance.
Yeah, like it's dependent on less or like fewer features that the UFC can't control, I guess. Like if you do have somebody, and you know, if you got Endeavor and a bunch of rich friends around, like you probably know somebody with an island. You probably can make that work, I guess, and then get a cage set up, and I guess it's not too hard. But then it's also like we've seen what the UFC traveling carnival looks like when it pulls into a new town, and you wonder how an island, like a private island, is going to be able to accommodate all that stuff. Because you got a bunch of fighters coming in, and they all got to stay somewhere. They got to have somewhere to work out and train. They got to have somewhere to cut weight. You got to have something that can feed them all, and you also got to have something that can take care of injuries they sustain in the fight. So you're going to have, if you're going to have that all on the island, or are you going to have to be like requiring stuff from nearby islands or nearby mainland to help you meet those needs? I don't know. Like, it seems like a logistical challenge. And it also seems like where I question it is, are we doing all this just to get through a couple difficult months where you won't be able to have fights? Because doesn't it seem like I thought the UFC Apex was going to end up serving a good purpose for this. And like, you have it all right there. If you get to a point, like maybe by May or June, you get to a point where the Nevada State Athletic Commission says, okay, you could have fights at the Apex. And, you know, if you don't have a crowd and things like that, we feel comfortable enough about it. Like, that seems realistic. And it seems like that would be much easier than completely relocating to a private island, especially if it's just as a short-term measure to keep the wheels moving.
Yeah. I mean, I think you raise a lot of good logistical questions about what kind of facility it would even be available, what kind of facility you would even be able to find that could host all that stuff. So I give it probably an equal chance of actually coming off as UFC 249. Like, the only thing that makes me feel like it will become a reality is that Dana White has talked so much about it at this point that it almost feels like he has to pull off Fight Island even more so than UFC 249. Like, he's been very strident and uncompromising about how that will be a thing that happens. Of course, he's also said the same stuff about like Zuffa boxing, and now it seems somewhat less of a sure thing that will happen. But I don't know, man. I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens with Fight Island. And an additional logistical challenge here for Ben moving forward will be how to get in its 42 events this year, if that's a thing that it still wants to do. Dana White says it is, and that's what we think it's got to do in order to get that hefty licensing fee from ESPN for this year. I don't know, given that it was Disney and ESPN that finally stepped in and had him pull the plug on UFC 249. I don't know if we would renegotiate that number of fight cards or what. But as for now, they say they're going to try to get their full 42 events in this year. And we had a full slate of matchups here coming up in the next couple months that we think have either been canceled or postponed. What do you think, Ben, the rest of the year? Are we actually going to get to 42 UFC events this year, even if it means holding two, maybe three fight cards a week?
You know, that one I kind of doubt the least. I think that the UFC says, hey, we're going to do 42 fight cards, whether you want to see them all, whether we have the manpower to make them all good, whatever it takes. We will hit that number. I believe that the UFC can absolutely do it. I mean, we've seen the UFC hold three events in a row. We've seen the UFC hold two events on the same day on different continents. So I think if you get to a point when the broader world is capable of holding those kind of events again, and especially if the UFC figures out that it can go forward somewhere like the Apex, I don't have any problem imagining a scenario where the UFC just churns out events.
Yeah, and I think, you know, given the raised attention that was paid to it over the last couple of weeks, it probably goes without saying that Ferguson versus Nurmagomedov would be our most anticipated fight here in the second half of the year, assuming things get back to normal order. Aside from that matchup though, Ben, is there one that was either already on the books or one that was a potential matchup that you would be the most excited to see the UFC get back together in the fall or whenever this happens?
Well, you know, we already talked about Khabib versus Tony, but Francis Ngannou versus the Biggie Boy, that one I was pretty pumped about, man. I won't lie to you. That one had heavyweight fun written all over it. That one said we were going to get anywhere from 30 to 90 seconds of heavyweight fun, and I was super into that idea.
Yeah, I would second that emotion. You got to think that that one lands somewhere once the fights start again. That would even probably be like a Fight Island potential bout. Depending on where the Biggie Boy's coming in from, I'm not exactly sure. I would also, you know, Cormier versus Miocic, probably going to happen at some point, as long as we can get Cormier to stick around for it. It seems like he's going to, as long as Miocic as a first responder emerges unscathed from the coronavirus pandemic, I would think that we would get that fight. What about the notion of Jorge Masvidal against Kamaru Usman? Because that was floated out there during all this chaos as a potential UFC 249 fill-in fight almost. Is that the welterweight title fight to make, do you think, once things get back together, or is there a different fight out there that you'd like to see at that weight class?
No, I mean, I think that's the one. I think that for some reason at welterweight doesn't seem like it is tougher than in any other weight class to get people to just accept what seems to be the most logical options. I don't know who the sticking point is in a lot of these, but it seems like you get a whole bunch of people talking about how they want to fight. They are up to fight. Let's fight, you and me. And then it seems so difficult to actually get anything on paper in that weight class, especially right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you. That's probably still the fight to make. There was Henry Cejudo was supposed to defend the bantamweight crown first against Jose Aldo at UFC 50. This one was going to be on May 9th in Brazil. We had flirted with the idea of Dominic Cruz once it became clear that Jose Aldo was not going to be able to make this date. And again, very telling of Henry Cejudo's management style, I guess you would say, of his own career, that he went from thinking he was going to fight Jose Aldo to immediately mentioning the name of Dominic Cruz as the next guy that he wanted to defend that title against, neither of which would probably be, you know, in the top 2, 3, 4 number one available contenders for the 135-pound crown. But assuming that one of those two guys is going to be next up for Cejudo, Ben, which one would you like to see more?
Honestly, when they started throwing around the idea of Dominic Cruz and Henry Cejudo, I got a little excited about that. I don't know. Maybe it's
more,
just the
more so than Jose Aldo?
Yeah, the Jose Aldo one never seemed to make a whole lot of sense to me anyway, just because he had one fight in the division and he didn't win it, and then we immediately slotted him in for a title shot. That just seemed to make no sense. I also don't think it's going to be the difference maker in pay-per-view sales the way maybe Henry Cejudo does if he's looking for money fights. I don't know that Jose Aldo brings a ton of new attention and a ton of new buys to a fight. Dominic Cruz seemed like a fun idea, but it also, when I had to go back and look and realize, oh yeah, he hasn't fought since that 2016 loss to Cody Garbs, it's like, okay, that's a long time. That's a long time to be off to jump right in there against Henry Cejudo. But I don't know. That will be one of the interesting things for me, is to see when we start to get moving again, will you hold on to any of those where you felt like, okay, we were scrambling around for a second choice and maybe we hit on something that was better than the first choice, or do you just try to reset everything? I don't know.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. You also had Amanda Nunes versus Felicia Spencer for the women's featherweight title was targeted for UFC 250 at that same event. You had kind of an interesting heavyweight scrap there in Alexi Olenek versus Fabricio Werdum that was supposed to go off at that event. Here's one that I think could be interesting to see what they do with it. Max Holloway in an immediate rematch against Alexander Volkanovski was supposed to be UFC 251 in Perth, Australia. You were also going to get Chevy Shanks, Valentina Shevchenko against the Whispering Warrior, Joanne Calderwood on that card. Is that still going to be the featherweight title fight that you would most like to see, considering that maybe we have time for some other 145-pound guys to either get healthy or get interested and make themselves known as potential title contenders?
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, that one, let's say I'm open to being convinced one way or another. I don't know if I have any too strong opinions that I feel like something I feel like absolutely needs to happen there. I think maybe for some people, that's what will be a good thing about this interruption in the regular schedule, is a chance to make your case anew as the whole thing quiets down for a little bit, and then you get a chance to remind us who you are and what you're about.
Yeah. Just a smattering of other fights that were out there. Singing and Dancing, Jack Hermanson against Chris Weidman was supposed to be on May 2nd in Oklahoma City. You also had Ryan Hall against Ricardo Lamas, Edson Barboza versus Josh Emmett, Carlos Diego Ferreira against heartthrob Drew Dober. You were going to do May 16th in San Diego with Alistair Overeem versus Walt Harris. That's a fight that's been bounced around a little bit because I believe it was supposed to go down in Portland originally. So it'll be interesting to see where that one lands. Ben, the UFC was supposed to go to damn Kazakhstan in June. And who knows, man? Who knows which one of those fights hold together? Who knows where they land? Who knows what happens with the rest of that announced slate that was supposed to go down this spring?
Yeah. Yeah. Who knows indeed?
All right, let's go ahead and do just saying stuff, and then we'll get out of here for this week. Ben, did you see this story about how Anthony Smith had to fight off a home invader?
Yeah, it's a crazy story.
As if living through a pandemic, and let me say, from a personal standpoint, I feel Anthony Smith here being on home isolation with his wife and three daughters. I feel you, Anthony Smith. I know what that's like. I know a little bit of what that's like. Not only does he have all that stuff going on, Ben, he's got a crazy person breaking into his house too. I'm just saying, that's a lot, man. That's a lot of stuff to deal with.
Man, his description of that whole thing is really gripping. Like, he does not shy away. Like, he's not trying to tough guy his way through it and be like, no, I wasn't scared. I just put the hurt on this guy. Like, he tells you like how utterly terrifying the whole situation is. And it sounds like something just like directly lifted out of my nightmares. It's worth reading.
Have you seen, there's a video of it. Have you seen the, there's like a doorbell video of the guy who ends up breaking into Anthony Smith's house where he's just like, just looks like a complete crazy person. He's just basically out there trying doors, and when they're locked, he's screaming like a madman. It's crazy.
Well, that's terrifying.
Well, Chad, also, I guess I would just add, I'm just saying, how bad a luck does that dude have? He's out trying to break into houses. And he ends up breaking into the house of ultimate fighting fighter Anthony Smith, former title challenger. That's bad luck, man.
I mean, there's an element of luck here. I will not dispute that. But a lot
You're saying
of
this guy's maybe making his own luck?
A lot of it was choices. Yeah, I don't know if it was all luck. My just saying stuff this week, Chad, I was reading today on the internet that some public health expert was saying that they think the time that it will be safe to really gather in mass for like sporting events with crowds and concerts with full crowds in the arena and everything, that time will be fall of 2021. And
that's a long time.
I'm just saying, Chad, you and I and some close friends of ours, we have tickets to see Guns N' Roses at Washington Grizzly Stadium on August 26th. seems like we're all going to maybe have to make some sacrifices during this thing. And just like how I wasn't able to see Guns N' Roses when I was really a major fan of theirs back in 1992 when they were on the stadium tour with Metallica, that ended up being just a disaster throughout the entire thing. Now, here I am all these years later, 40-year-old man, excited about buying tickets to go see some sad, bedraggled version of Guns N' Roses, and along comes a pandemic. Maybe this is just my personal musical version of Khabib versus Tony. I'm just saying.
That's heavy, man. Guns N' Roses is your Ferguson versus Nurmagomedov.
Just saying.
Wow. Well, that's going to do it for this week's Co-Main Event podcast. As everyone knows, we'll be back on Wednesday over on the Patreon for the Not-So-Live chat. Then back again Friday for the Power Hour. If you haven't checked out the Patreon, get over there and join the team. We have a lot of fun. There's a lot of content. The discourse, as ever, remains unfettered. And 1 week from today, we will be back for another episode of this show, live and free for everyone, the Co-Main Event podcast. What will we talk about? I have no idea. Really don't know, but we'll figure it out. As for right now, we are done. We are through. We are out. I mean, I guess the show's not really live, but it is free. I mean, it's live as we sit here. You and I are currently doing it live.
Yeah, we're live. We're live for each other.
I mean, I'm probably not going to go back and edit it out, that big sneeze that you cut while I was doing my just saying stuff.
It was a cough, and I was really trying to hold on until the end of the segment, but you talked too long.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yep.
My fault.
Yep.
My fault. Sorry about that.
100%
your fault. Yeah. Boy, I wish I had known, you know, just wish I had known that your personal peril and plight there. I would have wrapped it up early for you.